Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Andrew Smith, and I'm just going to do a quick introduction to the Working Party. Firstly, on behalf of the Institute, on behalf of the General Insurance Practice Committee, and indeed on behalf of the Working Party, welcome to the Institute for what hopefully is quite a thought-provoking conversation, and I'm sure it will be. The topic for today is profit margins in regulated insurance markets, and the Working Party are aptly named the Profit Margins Working Party. I'm sure they'll want to hear lots of questions at the end of the session, so feel free to ask your questions at the end of the session and save them up and think about what you want to ask the Working Party. The Working Party was established back in January. At that time, there was a number of rejections of rate filings, and the Working Party was established to look at the levels of profit in regulated insurance markets. So I'll quickly introduce the Working Party. Not all of them are speaking today. I'll ask them to quickly give you a wave so you know who's who in the zoo. Darren Robb, Stuart McCarthy, Andrew Doman, Jeff Atkins, Rick Shaw, Sid, are you there too? Siddharth Parameshwaran, and the attendees, the Working Party members who are not here are Adrian Gould, and David Whittle and Mike Sherris. I haven't left anyone out there, have I, gents? So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Stuart, who's going to kick off the presentation today.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. And on behalf of the Working Party, thanks very much for joining us here today. I guess as a Working Party, we've decided we've got a fairly challenging topic to deal with today, and in fact this year. This particular topic around profit margin for regulated industries is quite a big one. It's occupied the minds of a lot of people, a lot of academics, a lot of practitioners. I guess when I think about this, it's probably because profit margin, obviously, is an essential element for the pricing process. Any pricing actuary who sits down to formulate a set of rates has to think through what an appropriate profit margin is. And then if we turn our minds to regulated markets, we have another dimension here as well. We have a situation of where society, via the government and the regulator, have a desire to regulate the level of prices in a certain industry. And if they get that regulation wrong, if they set prices or the profit margin at a level that's either too high or too low, then we can get, a difficult situation. Either a situation where capital providers are not willing to step up and offer the product, or a situation where we're getting excessive profits going to those capital providers. So it is quite an important topic, not just for actuaries, but also for the broader society. See if I can work the technology. Here we go. So what are we looking at doing? As a Working Party, we're looking at producing a paper for the November GI seminar. And today is really a bit of a way station for us. It's a chance to present our thoughts to date in hopefully a coherent format and get feedback. And now at this stage, our thoughts certainly don't necessarily represent the official position of the GIPC or the Actuaries Institute. And while this is a public document, we'd ask you do respect the draft nature of these comments. Now, if I talk for a second about our terms of reference, it's around summarising and assessing the input that economics makes to the question of what is an appropriate profit margin, including the measure of capital that supports insurance business and also the required rate of return on that capital. And as I said, what we're looking to do is provide a framework that actuaries can use to advise on an appropriate profit margin in a regulated insurance market. Members of the Working Committee, the Working Party, we've already heard their names read out. I would ask, obviously, provide feedback during our discussion time today, but also if you have any further feedback, please direct that to Darren. There's an email address up here. Or, of course, please go ahead and have conversations with any member of the Working Party. We're certainly interested in discussing and debating these topics in a lot more detail. Price regulation. What do we mean by price regulation? I mean, let's face it, everybody, any business is subject to regulation. We've got to obey the laws of the country, consider the customs and common practices. Everybody's subject to regulation. There are some industries, though, which are subject to a greater degree of scrutiny than others. This can occur for a variety of reasons. They may be mandatory products. They may be products that attract special public interest. It may be a monopoly situation. So in that situation, you find that society, through government, regulates either the prices or, more commonly these days anyway, the profit that the providers of those products can earn. And I guess if we look back in history, in years past, it's more commonly been the former. Regulators have defined the level of pricing that's acceptable for these markets. I guess in more recent years, the approach has become a bit more subtle in terms of regulators defining a certain level of profit margin. And I guess my interpretation of that is, in this sort of, you know, our modern economy, very fast moving, it's less practical for regulators to define prices as they have in the past, and more appropriate for them to define a level of profit. The quote on the slide talks of dates from the 40s, but I think the principle still remains the same. In the sense, in order to attract capital providers to a certain market, it's necessary to allow them to earn a certain rate of return on that capital. Otherwise, we might end up in a situation whereby capital providers are simply not willing to step up and offer the product, which can have fairly dire consequences for people who need to use that product and society in general. But equally, we want to avoid the situation of excessive profits being allowed to be earned by those capital providers. We've termed ourselves we talk about profit margins, and I guess for convenience in the general insurance space, we talk about profit margin as being premium, less cost of claims, less expenses, plus investment income on your technical provisions gives you your profit margin. Divide by premium, you get a percentage profit margin. That's all very clear to everybody, I'm sure. A couple of observations there. That's clearly a pre-tax measure of profit. It also doesn't take into account earnings on the capital that supports the business. So in that sense, profit margin is a useful, convenient measure of profit that you can use across the insurance industry, the GI industry, but it's not complete in the sense it doesn't give you a return on capital. Obviously, return on capital is a more widely used measure across the economy as a whole. In terms of our approach, we've been working through the following topics, and today is very much about talking about the first bullet point there, a theory of competitive prices. We're also thinking through the numerous practical considerations and difficulty in this space. The regulatory perspective is obviously fairly crucial, and again, our focus is on working towards developing a framework for actuaries to use in practice around advising on appropriate profit margins in a regulated market. In a moment, I'm going to pass over to Darren Robb, who'll talk in more detail around some of these issues. We're going to talk about microeconomics and how that provides a theoretical framework for considering pricing in a competitive market. We're also going to talk about other approaches that actuaries and others have used in GI pricing, so what we've labelled the traditional approach, the internal rate of return approach, and also the Myers-Cohen model, which has grown out of financial economics and is an approach fairly widely used, particularly in the US. Before I pass to Darren, I guess I'd make one more comment, which is, if it appears, how about that? This stuff is difficult. Insurance is not a simple industry, and when you add in a whole lot of complexity around financial economics and so forth, it is quite a difficult topic. And while we'd ask you to hold your questions until we get to the end, just so we can get through the material, I'd really encourage everybody to ask those questions, because I'm sure if there's something you don't quite understand or don't agree with, we'd like to hear from you. And if you don't say it, perhaps nobody will. So please participate freely in the discussion at the end. Now, on that note, I'd like to hand over to Darren. Over to you.
Thanks, Stuart. So as Stuart just said, This topic for insurance is really difficult, so I'm actually not going to talk about insurance at the start. I want to talk about something a lot easier to help us think through the ideas, something that will hopefully be a bit more intuitive and a bit more obvious to everyone. So I'm going to talk about water. I'm going to talk about bottles of water. And I'm going to talk about a company that makes and sells bottles of water. That's a picture of there. So if we just think about this example company that we're talking about, and I just want to start by thinking about the production process that this company uses. So to make bottles of water, you need some supplies, so there's some inputs going into the production process. You've got staff who are providing labour as well. And you've also got capital that is being used and going into the production process. And the output of that production process is that you have a product that can go to consumers. So I guess these are kind of going back to the fundamentals and basics of economics. What is going on in this process and thinking about the manufacturing process? So let's start with a few definitions then. So the supplies are any goods and services being used in that production process. The labour is human time and effort being used in that process. So far, pretty straightforward. I think the capital is a little bit harder, so we'll just dwell on that for a second. So we're defining the capital as any initial assets used in the production process. And the important word there is to create future goods and services. So capital allows you to make future goods and services. Now, in economics, there are actually four types of capital that we're talking about here. There's inventory, so the stock of units that you can sell. There's physical property that might be used in the production process or required. There's brand, so brand to enable the company to sell the products that they want to sell. And there's other intangible assets, which is a broad term but includes intellectual property and a whole range of other kind of intangible assets used by a company to make products. So just a little bit more definition for a second. We looked at Wikipedia and just had a look at what Wikipedia says about capital. And you'll see it actually says capital in brackets economics. So we're talking about economics here. And the definition of capital, it might be too hard to read for the people in the back, but it basically says those already produced durable goods used in the production of goods and services. Now, the thing I want to just draw your eyes to is the little statement right at the top of that definition, not to be confused with financial capital. So if we look at financial capital on Wikipedia and see what that says, financial capital is money used by businesses. So I just want to highlight that those two concepts have some kind of difference. And from now on, if I'm meaning economic capital, I'll use the words economic capital. And if I'm meaning financial capital, I'll use financial capital. So if we go back to our company and we think about the cash flows that this company would have. So the supplies that we had before have some kind of cost, the production costs. So there's money flowing out to those production costs. The labour that was provided before as an input has a cost as well. And so there's cash flows flowing out to that labour in the form of wages. The capital, and I'm using the word economic capital here, has a cost and there's a cash flow flowing out to that economic capital. And there's also cash flow coming in from consumers if we manage to sell any of these water bottles. So there's cash flow flowing in there. So there's a key question here. The question is, what field of study, what area of thought helps us to relate those cash flows together and helps us to examine those cash flows? Microeconomics is the study of markets where goods and services are sold by producers to consumers. It meets every single one of the definitions of you know, the bottled water scenario that we've just talked about, meets each of those. So I think microeconomics is the appropriate field of study to use to examine the price of goods and services. So what does microeconomics say? I should point out, microeconomics, it's part of what they call the neoclassical synthesis in economics. It's the, I guess I would call it the mainstream economics. It's divided into microeconomics and macroeconomics. Micro here is not meaning small, tiny businesses like microfinance or microinsurance. It's microeconomics meaning businesses, households, markets. So what does it say? So microeconomics talks about competitive markets. It talks about monopolies. It talks about oligopolies. And it talks about competitive markets. There's an axiom in microeconomics, which is that in a competitive market, the price is the opportunity cost of all inputs. So that statement is axiomatic, and it's fundamental to what we're going to talk about. So in a competitive market, price is the opportunity cost of all inputs. So what does that mean for our bottled water scenario? So that would mean the price for the bottled water would be the production costs that we had as an input, the wages that we had as an input, and something that we've called normal profit. Now, normal profit has a defined meaning within microeconomics. It actually is defined to be economic capital times the cost of that capital. So it's the return provided to economic capital. And the economic capital is those four components that we had before. So it's the inventory, physical property, brand, and other intangibles. And the cost of capital is defined as the opportunity cost for the same risk. And that opportunity cost is a key concept in economics and in microeconomics. Opportunity cost is the best alternative use. So that's normal profit for our industry. Now, I just want to add an extra element into this scenario. Imagine that the government introduced a recycling scheme for empty bottles of water. So consumers who bought their bottle of water could return that empty bottle to the company and get a refund on that bottled water. And imagine that it's compulsory on all the companies to provide this recycling refund. So let's think about the cash flows of this scenario now. Well, all the ones that we had before are the same. There's still production costs, there's still labour, and there's still economic capital. The consumers who are buying the product are purchasing it, so there's still cash flow flowing to the company. But there's one extra element now, which is the recycling refund. So now there's some money flowing back to the consumers as well. But it's still a company selling bottles of water. So we know that microeconomics is still the appropriate field to use to look at prices. And we know that microeconomics states that the price is the opportunity cost of all inputs in a competitive market. But our formula is now a little bit different. So we had production costs, we've still got them. We've got wages. There's this extra element now, which is the recycling refunds that we've added in. So that's an extra input with a cost. And there's normal profit as well. And normal profit is the same as what we had before. It's the economic capital times the cost of capital. Now imagine if the government was extremely concerned about recycling and introduced it made it compulsory that companies had to hold funds aside to enable them to cover future recycling refunds. Now, imagine that there would be a net opportunity cost of holding those additional funds aside. Now, this is actually an example of financial capital. It's not economic capital that we were talking about before because it's not related to future sales. So economic capital was related to future sales of goods and services. This is financial capital, pure and simple, financial capital. We're going to call it allocated capital because it's the capital that's allocated to the recycling refunds, the bottles that have already been sold. Now, if we think about the cash flows for this company, we've got all the same cash flows that we had before. Nothing's changed there. Maybe the amounts of them might have changed a little bit. There might be some extra expenses. But we've got this extra element, which is allocated capital, which is a fund that's being held aside. And so there's some kind of pattern of cash flows to this allocated capital. But at its core, this company is still a producer selling bottles of water in a market. So we know that microeconomics is the appropriate field of study to use to come up with, to examine prices. And microeconomics talks about competitive markets, and it says that in a competitive market, the price is the opportunity cost of all inputs. So now the formula is slightly expanded again. So we had the production cost that we had before. We've got the wages that we had before. We've got the recycling refunds. But now there's an additional element, which was that net opportunity cost of holding that allocated capital aside. And there's still the normal profit. Normal profit would be the same as what we had before. Economic capital times the cost of capital. So in those two slides, we now have formulas for our bottled water, our fictional bottled water company, for price and profit. So we've settled that one. Now we'll turn our attention to insurance. Imagine an insurance company that collects premium, pays claims and expenses, and it's compulsory for that insurance company to hold money aside to cover the risk on future claims on policies already sold. We'll call that allocated capital. There is a net opportunity cost of holding that allocated capital. So if we think about this insurance company and think about the cash flows of this insurance company, there are some kind of expenses that we'll call production costs. There are staff who are providing their labour, so there's going to be some kind of cost for the labourer. There is some kind of economic capital required as well, and there'll be some kind of return on that economic capital. The consumers who are buying the insurance are paying money to the insurance company, so there's money flowing in. There's also money flowing out. There's claims flowing out, usually to the consumer, but not always. So there's kind of a dual impact there. And then there's this allocated capital fund as well. And there's some kind of pattern of cash flows to that allocated capital. But at its core, this is an insurance company selling a product. And because of that, microeconomics is the appropriate field to use to look at prices. It's just like with the bottled water scenario. So what does microeconomics say? Well, if we want a competitive market, in a competitive market, price is the opportunity cost of all inputs. So for the insurance company, that would mean the production costs that we had, the wages, plus the claim payments now, plus the net opportunity cost of holding the allocated capital, plus normal profit. And normal profit is the same kind of formula that we had for the bottled water scenario. The normal profit is economic capital times the cost of capital. Inventory, physical property, brand, and other intangibles, and the opportunity cost on that capital. So on those two slides represent fairly simple formulas for the price and profit of insurance in a competitive market using the microeconomics framework that I've outlined. So in summary, microeconomics, we think it's the appropriate field of study to use to examine competitive prices. It has a theoretically sound framework for prices and profit of insurance. And we just want to have a look now at to see how this framework fits in with our traditional approach that GI actuaries in Australia often use. So what is the traditional approach? How do we often think about this? So usually, when we're doing pricing within Australia, we often think about the premium is equal to expected claims, discounted at the risk-free rate. Expenses, also discounted at the risk-free rate if they're in the future, plus a profit margin. And the profit margin there is conceptually based on what Stuart talked about at the start. It's based on an amount of capital and a return on that capital. And as Stuart said, we often use an internal rate of return method to kind of combine those two concepts into a profit margin. Now, it's those two concepts, the amount of capital and the return on capital. They're absolutely fundamental, and that is really where a lot of the debate has arisen. So I'm just going to dwell on those two concepts for just a second. So the amount of capital. So if we use this microeconomics framework that we've just talked about, the amount of capital is the economic capital plus the allocated capital. Now, in the insurance world, we actually use slightly different terms to that. We often call it financial capital and non-financial capital. That's in terms more closely related to what we would think of. And the rate of return on that capital, well, in the microeconomics framework, the return on capital is the opportunity cost on the allocated capital and the normal profit on the economic capital. Now, that opportunity cost, the opportunity cost of allocated capital, as I said before, opportunity cost is always the best alternative use. And we think that the best alternative use of allocated capital is to give it back to the shareholder. So we think that the shareholder's or the insurer's cost of capital is the right value to use for that opportunity cost of allocated capital. So essentially the rate of return on both the opportunity cost, both on the allocated capital and the economic capital would be the same. They would both be the WACC. Now the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital. So the combined cost of the debt and equity that is providing the capital. So the microeconomics framework that we've talked about fits easily into the traditional framework that we often use. It actually provides us a value for what amount of capital to use, and it provides us with a rate of return on that capital as well. I think it's important that we just spend a little bit of time and look at an alternative approach that has often been used in regulatory circles for this question. There's a model called the Myers-Cohen model. It's often used in the US, and it has been used in Australia as well, in regulated markets. So what is the Myers-Cohen model? So essentially the formula used in Myers-Cohen is the premium is the present value of expected claims plus the present value of expenses plus the present value of taxes, and the present value there, the cash flows are discounted at a risk-adjusted rate, not the risk-free rate, a risk-adjusted rate. Now, that's the pure Myers-Cohen. There have been people who have kind of adjusted that to allow for some other things like frictional costs. And that pure Myers-Cohen formula can also, you'll notice it doesn't refer to capital, but it can be used to come up with an amount of capital and a return on that capital. So effectively, we've got two alternative paradigms then that tell us about the amount of capital and the return on that capital. So if we just compare those a little bit more in detail, if I go through exactly what's in that formula for price between the microeconomics framework that I've outlined so far versus the Myers-Cohen model that's in use in regulatory circles. So the Myers-Cohen formula includes revenue, premium, so a measure of premium, revenue, expenses, claims, and allowance for risk in claims. It discounts at the risk-adjusted rate. In the microeconomics framework that I outlined, it considers revenue, expenses, claims, plus the net opportunity cost of holding the allocated capital, plus normal profit on economic capital. So if you compare the two columns, two things stick out. One is that there's clearly just an extra item in the microeconomics approach. Normal profit on economic capital, it just doesn't appear on the other side of the page. It's not there. So that's one key difference. Another key difference is this line here. So I'll just spend a couple of slides just to kind of talk through that difference and just help to kind of explore what that difference means. First of all, in the microeconomics framework, the opportunity cost of holding allocated capital, it's the cost to the company. But in the Myers-Cohen framework, the allowance for risk in the claims is the risk inherent in the claims themselves. So that's kind of one difference, and I'll just explore that for a second. So when the Myers-Cohen model discounts the cost of claims at a risk-adjusted rate, that means that if there's high risk in the claims, we use a high discount rate. And if there's low risk in claims, we use a low discount rate. And then premiums are actually set equal to that discounted cost of claims. Now, it's important to point out that in practice, when the Myers-Cohen framework is actually used, people often use as the measure of risk the amount of correlation with stock market returns. So they kind of define the risk as the correlation with the stock market. So essentially, if we just kind of work that through, it means that if there's a high correlation with the market in the claims, then we'd use a high discount rate. So we'd discount more, and that would lead to a lower cost of claims and therefore a lower premium And vice versa, if you had a product with a low correlation with the market, you'd use a low discount rate, meaning there'd be less discounting on the claims, which would give you a higher discounted cost of claims and therefore a higher premium. So the relationship between correlation and premium is inverse. A low correlation would give you a high premium, and a high correlation would give you a low premium. One distinction there is that then the correlation is often assumed, for insurance products, the correlation is often assumed to be either zero or slightly negative, which just kind of adds a little bit more complexity to that. Now, we looked at the differences in the formula before between Myers-Cohen and microeconomics, but I think it's just important to just dwell on the difference in the capital. So remember I said amount of capital and the return on that capital. They're the two fundamental measures that really drive this whole result. So if we look at the Myers-Cohen framework, the amount of capital used in the Myers-Cohen framework is financial capital only. Whereas we saw that in the microeconomics framework that we talked about, it includes both financial and non-financial capital. So that's the amount of capital is actually different between the two approaches. But the rate of return on that capital is also different. So in the Myers-Cohen framework, the rate of return on capital is based on what assets the capital is invested in. So if you have an amount of capital and you invest that capital, the rate of return on the capital is based on the assets that the capital is invested in, which for an insurance company may often be fixed interest securities for at least part of it. And then there's also allowance for issues around double taxation and other frictional costs of holding the capital. But in the microeconomics framework, it's a different and a simpler approach to the rate of return. The rate of return is simply the average weighted average cost of capital. So it's the insurer's WACC is the rate of return on that capital. So that outlines the differences between the two approaches. So the view of the working party, having considered this, is that we think the Myers-Cohen framework, that model, may not be the most appropriate model to use for regulatory use. We think that the amount of capital that should be included is both the financial capital and the non-financial capital, and that the rate of return on that capital should be the insurer's weighted average cost of capital. Now, I just wanted to go through one, almost like a numerical example, just to kind of give you a flavour of what this means in terms of in numbers almost. So if I just have kind of a worked example where I think about the total profit of an insurance product, the profit would be the return on both the financial capital and the non-financial capital, thinking in terms of the language that we outlined in the microeconomics framework. And the rate of return would be that profit divided by the value of the capital. So the total profit divided by the value of the capital gives you that return, so the weighted average cost of capital. Now, if we were to make one assumption, if we were to assume that the amount of financial capital was two-thirds of the size of the combined capital, so two-thirds of the financial plus non-financial capital, that assumption would allow us to slightly rearrange the denominator on this formula. If we just remove the non-financial capital from the bottom, so we're reducing the size of the denominator to just financial capital, and we're assuming that that financial capital was two-thirds of the total. So if we reduce the denominator by two-thirds, the value of the fraction itself will increase by a factor of 1.5. Now, that formula there is total profit divided by the financial capital. In insurance circles, that formula is what we often call ROE. In insurance, we often call that return on equity. So this formula is suggesting that with a couple of the kind of the key little assumptions that I've outlined just there, that in a competitive market, the return on equity, using that definition, would be 1.5 times WACC. Now, 1.5 times WACC is a common benchmark used by companies in practice. So that's the end of the content so far. I'm just going to hand over to Jeff Atkins now, who will wrap up with a few little extra things to think about and next steps, and then open to questions.
Oh, good job, Darren. How many hours did we spend chewing that over? So in 40 minutes, 79 people have got it, just like that. Yeah? Well, I don't know. If I go back to what Stuart said at the start, we found this a very challenging task. And we were given the goal of coming up with a framework that is sound and that actuaries can use and that in an implied manner the profession would generally support as appropriate, and subject to further discussions, we might like to think that regulators would regard that framework as appropriate as well. Now, we can only take this one step at a time, and so what we'd like to do, just when I get through these last couple of slides, is just really draw out people's perceptions and questions in order to, A, help us to kind of work out if we're actually onto something here or we're completely off with the fairies, and B, think about how to consolidate the arguments and communicate them to people at large. So we've got a few things that we haven't tackled yet. Other than Darren having an example calculation of the non-financial capital being a third of the total or equivalent to a half of the financial capital, that's a nice, neat example because it produced 1.5 times WACC, but that really should be regarded only as an example. So we haven't really thought about how to kind of work out or a framework, an appropriate framework for working out this economic capital. Is there such a thing as inventory in insurance businesses? How do you deal with the brand and the other intangibles? Another thing that we haven't really tackled in detail is to put ourselves in the regulator's shoes here and try and work through the various arguments that come up in a regulatory framework. Perhaps in typical actuarial manner, we tried to work out what we thought was right first before we worked out how to convince people that it was right. And I will just move quickly on to roughly how we see our next steps. So we've clearly got to socialise this. And our starting point is to socialise it with the profession that's engaged us and given us this task as a working party. So other than a little bit of private socialisation by Darren, this is really our main step in starting discussion with the profession of, I'm not sure I'd necessarily call it new Darren, but of this proposed approach. And really that discussion will only be useful to us if we do get feedback and input and questions. If all of that goes more or less according to plan, then we've got some more work to do on the intangible side, and we probably should do a little more work on specifying converting WACC to profit margins and whether IIR really is the most suitable framework and some of the nuances around that. And as Stuart said at the start, we are aiming for a paper to be published at the GI seminar, and without knowing quite what the profession wants to do about adopting views of working parties as a professional position, we're kind of hoping that by that point we'll have something that either the profession's able to kind of adopt as being a fair thing, or if not, that individual members who were involved with this in one way or another have had a good opportunity to think about it and form their own views. So look, at that point, I think we should open to questions. You did a great job on the timing, Darren, so we've actually got a nice, comfortable amount of time. So let's see what people think. And we'll need to just call in our institute hosts who will run the microphone because, A, we've got a few people who've dialed in on the phone, and, B, the proceedings will be recorded. And in that light, can I just say, if someone wishes to say something that they don't want to appear on the recording, for whatever reason, just say so at the start of your of what you want to say, and the recorders will make sure that that gets tagged and deleted from the recording. And the last housekeeping instruction is for the benefit of the phone people and the ones here and the recording, if you just let us know your name when you kick off. How are they doing, Darren? Okay, so Darren will be the microphone girl for a little while.
Chris Logan. I got a question about the capital model, I guess, for profit. So it sort of relies on the a passage of time to allocate the profit and that amount of capital. But for some risks, I know it's just an example, but you know, say we're playing two up or whatever, that we place our bets, but the amount of time is actually very small, so allocating that capital method doesn't seem to work. And is it the best method, I guess, is my question.
Now, I don't want to really field all the questions, so what I'm going to do is just ask one of the panellists to pick that up and give a response.
Could I just clarify, are you meaning...
I'll answer the easy ones, all right?
Are you meaning in the circumstance where the product had capital allocated for a very short amount of time? Is that the question?
Yeah, when it gets very small, it doesn't make sense.
I guess I would answer that by saying I think at the moment this is a very... we're not talking about allocating capital in the sense of what... real people do in their jobs on a day-to-day basis working in insurance companies. We're actually talking about a theoretical concept about how much capital is held, though I guess it is allocated. I'm not sure then.
I just think that's a great question, and that time element is something that we've not spoken about. Yeah, I've got my own thoughts about it, but to me that's a great example of a question that, you know, comes into someone's mind. And we should try and incorporate response to that in the material that we produce. My answer is yes, but there you go.
James Bassman, Allianz Australia. I just had a question that goes back more to the fundamentals. You keep mentioning capital. I assume what you mean is the excess of assets over liabilities in this context rather than assets.
Correct.
And what will be very interesting is to expand this discussion to consider, you know, the, a typical balance sheet of an insurance company and look at what that might look like. For example, looking at assets, you know, two-thirds investable assets versus non-investable assets might sound reasonable, but once you take off the liabilities, it's just kind of, it's interesting to see how that, how does that change the picture. Mm. And which portion do you subtract the liabilities from the investable and on the non-investable, or do you scale it down?
Mm. Probably not as explicit as it might be on these slides, but I think that's exactly what we had in mind when we're talking about trying to give more precision around the appropriate measurement of capital and the different components. Yeah, thanks, James. Anyone want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just add as well that I guess inherent in this framework is that there could be assets that are not on the balance sheet at all. In fact, you know, some of the intangible assets are likely to be off balance sheet.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of logical consequence that you'd be talking about some kind of normalised. What's the jargon word that gets used for enterprise value? Give or take the issue of debt, which again we sort of left there but haven't been very specific about. It presumably leads down the path of some kind of enterprise value measurement.
Jamie Reid. I've got a question to see if I'm keeping up. So intangibles would include brand and So the profit you're allowed to charge depends on the value of your brand, but presumably the value of the brand is all about the ability to make profit. So I know you've said intangibles is for later, but is that profit depends on brand, brand depends on profit? Is that insolvable?
Possibly. There's clearly a circularity in that, at least at the point one comes to try and measure by observation.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a good question. I don't think anybody would argue with the comment that as an insurance company you need more than simply financial capital or allocated capital to operate. You need a whole lot of things. You need people, systems, policies, procedures to operate as a starting point. Having a brand is necessary to distribute and sell your products. Having a strong brand will probably increase the value of your company, but is that necessary? I guess there's sort of that there are certain intangible assets that don't appear on the balance sheet as such that are necessary to operate as an insurer. There are others which, again, don't appear on the balance sheet, but increase the value of the business. And I think what you find across a number of different regulated industries is the regulator will take particular views on the type of assets that they will allow a return to be earned upon. And so I guess from a public policy point of view, you wouldn't want to encourage a capital provider in a regulated industry just to pump enormous amounts of money into their brand so they could earn a return on that. But on the other hand, you've got to recognise some of these tangible assets are necessary to run the company.
One possible way forward there is that when you talk about this opportunity cost, conceptually you're talking about the most efficient alternative use, not just any alternative use that happens to exist. And so there might be an angle there in being able to form a judgment about what's kind of needed as a ticket to play versus what might be a kind of optional extra or you know, some dressing up that may not warrant the regulator assessing it as being rewardable.
This is along similar lines to the previous questions. I really like what you've done. We looked at this about 8 years ago. There was I'm a veteran from the older discussions that long ago. There were issues then around frictional costs and market capitalisation, etc. And you've put that in a nice, neat little bucket for us and called it economic capital. The question is it a retrospective view or a prospective view? I think my observation of what you've put up there with your bottled water company is that it would be the accountant's view of book value. Economic capital is basically book value. So it would be like MTA. I mean, there's no difference really between in inventory, property, and money that's been sunk into things like brand. The problem is you don't necessarily keep track of those things. The amount that you've sunk into marketing campaigns isn't kept as a record, so you might struggle to actually work out what the book value of those things are. But that's essentially what the intangibles become, or even purchases of companies in the past, and that might still be there to be recorded. So because you haven't got a record of it, you then try and say, well, let's look at the market cap of the company and work backwards, and then you run into this problem that has already been raised, which is if you've got a license to print money by putting up profit margins, then you can increase your market cap if the market believes you that it can actually generate the profit margins. So I'm sort of veering towards thinking that will all work. What you've presented is really good and will work as long as you have the accountant's view of book value and basically your economic capital is NTA. But if you start trying to pull out these other things, you might run into some obstacles from the regulators. Mm.
Thanks, Nathan. Do I want to respond to that? I think we're in furious agreement.
Yeah, I think I would agree with what you said. I think the difficulty in understanding what a regulator might allow and what would need to be considered by a regulator, there's definitely a lot of work for us to do around understanding that. I think there's ways that you could do it around advertising and marketing, brand, that kind of stuff, that might be different to the other forms of economic capital, but that's what we've got to work through as a working party and as a profession, really. I think it's tough, yeah.
Another another question from Chris Logan. So another question I have is, I understand how if you have a capital model and you can allocate that return to different uses of capital, I guess you have to split it up some way. And the same with if you have brand or intangibles, you'd have to split it up between the bottling plant and the recycling plant. And is that possible, I guess?
I mean, the this may not directly answer the question, but let me start here. So I guess the accounting balance sheet has certain items on it, typically tangible assets, and you tend to find that when there are transactions, so company X buys company Y, you have a transition point where those intangible assets that are being bought are suddenly valued by the accountants and a value placed on those on the balance sheet. And there's a methodology around doing that kind of thing, which has been developed, I guess, in the accounting evaluations profession, which seeks to work through those kinds of issues. So how does one value a brand? How does one value customer relationships, workforce, IT systems, or all those kinds of things? Of course, if you look at a company that hasn't been subject to corporate activity, that's just grown organically, then those kinds of intangibles are never actually added to the books, because they're simply part of that base of intangible assets that don't get explicitly valued. So I guess the message there is that there's a body of knowledge, a methodology to undertake intangibles valuations, but it's only applied under certain circumstances. But I guess it could be applied more broadly. But of course, the challenge with those kinds of valuations is they're very opinion driven. To be frank about it, in the sense that if you're valuing intangibles that are not actively traded in the market, that it's very hard to come to a genuine view on what they're worth. Mm. So you get different valuation professionals taking different approaches and placing different values on the same asset. A bit like actuaries, I suppose.
Yeah. The other aspect of your question, Chris, is entirely valid, that an implication would be that whatever, however specifically one goes about identifying the appropriate amount of capital, that by its nature has to be apportioned to the particular class of business and cohort that you're doing the pricing for, and goodness knows, is the answer different for a monoline company than a diversified company? Is the answer different for an Australian listed company to an international company? I don't think we know the answers to those questions, but if you're going to have a workable framework, there needs to be a way of working through those things.
Tim Clark, IAG. Just following on, I guess, from Nathan's question about whether it's retrospectively measured or prospectively measured, in the real world, the regulators are going to want to be able to kind of test how well this thing has been applied, and often they'll do it on a retrospective view. I guess, at the moment, standard accounting doesn't really allow easy translation into the cohorts you're speaking about. We tend to do financial year P&Ls, and they look at that. So that's one element I wouldn't mind being considered as the working party goes forward. And secondly, this point about where the actuaries get their assumptions wrong on the cost of production, the claims cost, and you get prior year profits coming out because we thought we took prospectively the right decision, but retrospectively it came out something different. How do we think and handle and communicate that? And is there kind of a different risk cost where the downside risk, or the downside risk for a regulator, the upside risk for an insurer, is kind of weighted differently to the upside risk for the regulator, downside risk for the insurer? We're losing money against the capital. Concepts I don't know the answer to, but encourage you guys to think about it, because that's kind of the nub of the public problem we have.
In some ways, I think that's fair, Tim. As far as the retrospectivity is concerned, We discussed at some length but satisfied ourselves that we should work within the fully funded test as specified in the motor accidents legislation. At least my own view is that I would struggle to come up with anything with a better definition. So certainly a given for us is that the assessment of price adequacy is solely a prospective process. It doesn't avoid the issue of how you then deal with the past, and we haven't tackled at all the question of whether the central estimates of claims costs have been done in an appropriate manner. We've very neatly kept that as outside scope, and perhaps we can think a little bit about the control cycle that might belong with something like this. If I can re-express your question that way. And you guys want to add something?
Jamie Reid, question on sovereign risk. You said at the start that the price in a regulated market should be the same as in a competitive market. Did you think about whether there should be any compensation for sovereign risk? The fact you can get into the position we are in now where rates are turned down?
I'll say a couple of things and then other people can jump in as well. I'd be just careful about the first bit about us saying that the price in a regulated market should be the price in a competitive market. That's definitely a tough one. So essentially the history of the academic debate around pricing and profit margins in regulated markets has always has almost always assumed that it should just be the competitive price is what a regulator should consider. We've certainly thought about that. I guess at this stage we haven't necessarily come up with anything different to that, but at the same time I don't think that's our final position. We need to consider the regulator perspective. So, you know, our next steps by considering the regulator's perspective is that we might consider that the price in a regulated market might be different to the price in a competitive market. You know, off the top of my head, I can think of reasons why it might be higher, it might be lower. There's a range of factors there that you'd need to consider. So we're starting with the theory around competitive prices to work out that as the kind of the starting point. Get the starting point right, and then we can think about all the other issues that a regulator might want to consider to add into that and to make it a bit more realistic.
A regulator may not choose a service brand entirely, or you know, maybe not at all, particularly in a market where they force people to take out insurance. There are issues like that where you may end up with a different price to basically insurance was provided in a completely free market.
I'm going to just exercise the chairman's prerogative and throw something in. Just when we were chatting over a sandwich, one of my colleagues mentioned a four-letter word. It's the one starting with C. That's C-A-P-M. And you may not have noticed that didn't get a mention at all through here. We tossed around whether Myers-Cohn was similar to or some version of or a first cousin or unrelated without really completely knowing the answer to that question. We tossed around the idea of presenting this in the framework of financial economics, and we decided that was a bit dangerous and we didn't know enough to do that. So I'll have my quick go at that. My layman's interpretation of CAPM and indeed Myers-Cohn is that they are theories about the pricing of securities, something that has monetary value that can be traded backwards and forwards and retains its value after the trade. And certainly implicitly those pricing models are based on the idea that the investors, the endpoint at one end of that spectrum, and the ultimate issuers of the security, that there's a marketplace between those two. And with the exception of limited friction costs, it doesn't really give a place to the intermediaries in that chain. Now, my personal aha moment on this was when I figured out that you can't do that with insurance. It isn't a security. It's not something that you can buy and sell or trade. It's simply just not. It's patently wrong to say that, because you can only buy insurance from an insurance company, which has to have a license. It's got all these sunk costs. It has to have financial capital in addition to all those other things. So you can't, it's simply not valid to think about a transaction between a capital provider for an insurance company and an insurance policyholder. That's not a marketplace that you can examine. So for me, an important thing that didn't really come up explicitly in the presentation, which is fine, is the distinction between a security or a capital asset on the one hand, where the financial economics is all talking about, and a product or a good or service on the other hand, which is where we've fair and square categorised general insurance products. And that's my aha moment about why Myers-Cohn isn't right, to be perfectly blunt. Nathan. Please.
There may not be a secondary market for general insurance products, but there are secondary markets for life insurance products, whole of life and endowment. So there's no reason why there couldn't be a secondary insurance market for general insurance products, and therefore I don't see that CAPN doesn't necessarily apply to insurance product.
Well, we might just have to sort of hold that debate. Why isn't there a secondary market for general insurance? Well, my answer is because you can't have one. The laws and the economics both prohibit it. But, you know, that's fine. That's all grist for the mill, isn't it? Against the law. It's against the law.
Changes the moral hazard.
We can't model on possibilities that are illegal.
But they're doing that right now, aren't they? Selling damaged houses in Christchurch, where people are paying more on the assumption that they've collected on the original owner's insurance.
Yeah, but that's a very different economic transaction from the insurance coverage in the first place.
I think there are only some. It's very hard for a non-insurance entity to actually end up providing some of these. Service some of those risks. In particular, I think it's. Things like brands and the value of security. I think are things that if you did have, it's just very hard to actively trade those. Well, there is a cost to it in any case, which...
Fair enough, Nathan, and arguably for people who have come from a CAPM-type mindset, that's going to be a really important debate because, it's fundamental.
James Busman, I've got another one. Not that you guys don't have enough on your to-do list, but here's one more. I was just wondering how much thought you've put into monolines versus multi-lines and the level of diversification that might exist in a company. To my knowledge, it's not very common to allocate capital to classes on the basis of a different ROE or target ROE assumption, and to the extent that the market might demand different cost of capital or target return on capital for different types of classes, there might be an implicit level of cross-subsidy there. So to what extent does that perhaps disadvantage, say, a CTP insurer that's not very well diversified or not diversified at all versus another one that might be well diversified and have more vanilla products?
So I'm going to have a go at that.
I think that's on the to-do list.
James, my tuppence worth would be that empirical observation demonstrates that diversified insurance is the most economically efficient model. So if I was asked to put something forward, it would be that for this purpose we should be assuming a reasonably efficient model, and that would be diversified. There you go, there's something to chew on.
But there I think we may need to consider the regulator may have a different and more and sort of flatter perspective.
Look, they might, but they don't empirically, except for lenders' mortgage insurance, where APRA insists that they be monoline, which has got to be one of the most absurd economically based positions that I can think of.
I didn't hear that, Jeff.
Perhaps retrospectively I should ask that to not be included on the tape. What do you think, Dan? Okay, so yes, Nathan's got some more to say there. Somebody with directly relevant experience, Nathan, over too many years, huh?
Just one question. I haven't caught up with the literature in the US on this. There were some other papers after Myers-Cohn, Cummings and Phillips and various things. They tried to address this issue, or some of these issues, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Does what you've come up with reconcile with the way they've come up with it? Can you get support from what they're saying to support
your
economic model, capital model?
Yes, so the CAS in the US has been funding a project called the Risk Premium Project for 12 years now. That has specifically used the financial economics framework to try to improve on Myers-Cohen and allow for all of the practical frictional costs and insolvency risks and other factors that affect an insurance company, to try to modify the Myers-Cohen framework to come up with a number that's a bit more palatable to a lot of people that work in the industry. When we started our working party, our primary goal was to look at the CAS findings, to summarise them and to hopefully use them in our working party. Don't want to talk on behalf of people that aren't here, but I guess I can summarise a couple of things from Mike Sherris and Adrian Gould, who were both on the working party, and they kind of took on the role of reading all of that information and summarising it and seeing what value it had. There was nothing of use, really, that came out of that that was able to give us a practical framework that would actually provide formulas and numbers and answers. Mm. Essentially, it's coming at it from a different direction. Really.
It's been hard for us to kind of believe that all that work with all those bright people, and we at least, I mean, not me personally, because I didn't do all the reading. I listened to some of the people that had, and you know, we've had long sort of discussions about it. I think, you know, one way to boil it down would be to say that financial economics is the wrong model. I guess, yeah, that's sort of a different way of saying what we've already been saying, and I don't know. In one sense, we think what we're saying is blindingly obvious, because I guess to the extent that we've got a sort of consolidated background and training, that's kind of how we've always thought about things. But it's kind of iconoclastic in some ways, in terms of the academic or legal debate, and well, we're just. We're just walking forward slowly into that minefield, I think.
Brett Ward, IAG. Look, I just wanted to pass on, just based on those comments, Jeff, is that I don't necessarily encourage reaching the conclusion that financial economics doesn't work. I think it does. I think it's the way in which it's perhaps reconciled. So that whole issue, for example, referring to some of those papers, Cummins and Phillips, etc., is they do things like work out a company's WACC on the basis of the share market, on the basis of the market capitalisation of an insurer, and then for reasons which remain inexplicable to me, apply that to the tangible capital excluding the non-financial, exactly as Darren put up. So part of what I heard earlier was an attempt to reconcile why it is that some of those other, as you said, people have researched it for a long time, and try and reconcile the two is still a worthwhile exercise. So I wouldn't give up and say, no, that's not right, it's not wrong, here's a better model. I think they reconcile. I think they can be made to reconcile.
By the way, we concluded that CAPM is a perfectly valid approach for working out the weighted average cost of capital, but not the profit margin that goes in the price. Or a perfectly reasonable way. As Darren said so eloquently in one of our meetings, you can use CAPM to examine the price of a supermarket business, but you can't use it to examine the price of milk or bread.
One more question. Chris Logan. So in the first slide, I had a quote from a gas company, and I guess some of these CAPM regulatory models are being used by other industries. So has there been any look, have you looked into how they've resolved these issues?
Stuart, is that you or is it Rick?
Yes, we have. There's a lot of references to WACC. We've got a summary of it, which of how things are worked out in other regulated industries in Australia, which have wrestled with this problem.
Mm. Yeah, one of our work streams, I guess it's essentially utilities in Australia. But yes, we're trying to draw that together. Did we learn anything from that?
It's usually by reference to WACC, and a multiple of WACC is an appropriate return.
So we think that's okay. And then I think someone might have mentioned earlier that there's quite a lot of debate goes into defining what the relevant assets are, what the relevant capital is that the WACC should be based on. And then there's some other arguments about public good and natural monopoly that we don't think would be applicable in insurance, but we haven't really talked that over much yet.
Yeah, I think there are quite a diversity of approaches that that I guess fundamentally boil down to applying an appropriate rate of return to an appropriate asset base. But and what is an appropriate rate of return is generally fairly settled, but the definition of the asset base is more difficult across a lot of these industries. I guess the other observation I've taken away is the regulator does, not surprisingly, think quite a lot about what's good public policy, so what things they wish to encourage and what things they wish to discourage, as much as thinking about the level of appropriate return. So to encourage the capital provider to essentially invest in the right way and encourage the right behaviours.
Okay, we're starting to lose a few people, and it's not prohibited to finish a few minutes ahead of time. I think the meeting's scheduled to run until 2. Are there other comments and questions? Now, just in terms of the self-esteem of the working party members, could you just raise your hand if you encourage us to continue with our work and you think we've done something useful? One. Thank you very much. Dan Tess, you're out of here, mate.
He wrote it before.
That's right. We've picked up the baton from a long-running relay, haven't we? Okay, anything else? In which case, look, let me just thank the guys for putting in all the hard work. There has been hundreds of hours in different ways. Not finished yet, and really, really value the input. Some fantastic questions, which we need to deal with in our more complete material, some of which we sort of had in the can, but others are things that we really need to tackle. So thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of your week.